peaked in the first caller when he said he was wondering about what the message the Pleiadians had for us and what he was giving to Billy. Well, I have been corresponding with Billy Myers, and I have something in a letter. I will just read a portion of it to you, which I think might be very helpful. This was December 28, 1983. I asked in my letter what I could do to be helpful to help this world out of its mess. And he says, "You ask what you can do, and the answer is very simple. All the protests and demonstrations will come to naught, because humanity cannot be changed as a mass. But the change for the better must start with each individual. And if you can change yourself away from a materialistic way of thinking toward a more spiritual way of life and affect the persons around you, then you will have done as much as can be expected of you, of anyone else. All the best wishes for the future. Sincerely." I thought that would shed some light on what is expected of us.
It's right on target, too, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly is.
I mentioned earlier, I don't know if you heard this, Eleanor, but I in Beamship, the movie footage, Billy talks about balancing.
Yes.
The material with spiritual.
Yes.
And that sort of sums it up, too.
It certainly does. Well, it's been a great privilege to talk with you again. And when you see Wendell, give him our very best from David and Eleanor.
I certainly will. Thank
and
you,
much to both of you.
Thank you very much, Eleanor.
You're
appreciate
so
that.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
And for sharing that with us. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me is Lee Elders, from promising them that we would play a little bit more of the audio tape that we played a little bit earlier. And I want you to hear the sounds of the Pleiadian spacecraft. Now, the sounds seem to be real, and what we're going to hear is in the control room of one of the sound laboratories here in town. Which one was it, Lee?
It was the Excalibur Studios.
Excalibur
North
Studios.
North Hollywood, I believe.
So you'll hear the sounds, and you'll hear the comments of the sound engineers, who are fellows who know exactly what they're doing and what they're hearing, and also what they're seeing on their scopes, as this sound that was recorded by Billy Meyer on a Philips tape recorder, as I recall, on an occasion, and their excitement and a bit of perplexity about what they are hearing and seeing is quite evident. So let's listen to that for a moment.
There's going to be a lot of changes that you've got on the second analyzer. What is it telling you?
Okay, let's pick a point here on the screen. Let's pick that point there. You see how the level of that point is changing, it's going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
One point on the one line on the screen here is one frequency, and the whole screen is, you might say, a composite of a whole range of frequencies all the way from very low up to the top of the audio range.
Mm-hmm.
And a pure tone would simply show a peak, the line would be down the bottom here, and then it would be straight peak up like that,
mm-hmm.
if it was just one pure tone. But since there are many tones here, we get this pattern like this. And as you can see, it's not steady.
It's changing, yeah.
Which means the content keeps changing also in our tape or the signal.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that seems to be any consistency, of having consistency, is the amplitude modulation.
Yeah. If we look at an expanded view of the signal here, you
mm-hmm.
see that variation? So like that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That goes on the signal all the way through.
It does?
Yeah. That's the only stable pattern, as far as I can tell.
Can you show the frequency of modulation, of amplitude modulation, by speeding up the sweep on this?
Thank you. tones we have less of the other tones, we have more of the main single tone.
Mm-hmm.
Here you see it becomes
no,
more.
When they get all, we'll have a whole bunch on there at the same time. What does that mean?
That means you have several, or quite a few, different tones.
Quite a number of them.
Yeah, you can see the little peaks here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, compare this now to what we looked at before with the one peak. And you can see how many tones there are there. It's quite a few.
This is probably one of the most interesting things about the tape is that there are very, very many tones.
Yeah.
And they're all changing very fast.
For a moment there, we were locking in and we had three evenly spaced frequencies. See it there again?
I got them again.
Yeah.
Has this many tones and frequencies in it?
Well, there certainly aren't any synthesizers that have that have oscillators that are that many and that random, tuned to that many random things all changing simultaneously. That's, you know, that's not something inherent in any of the synthesizers that are used for, you know, recording or creating sound. This is something that has a tremendous amount of oscillation at different frequencies.
Yeah. So you're saying that it would be very difficult to produce this electronically?
Yes.
Would it be possible, though?
It is possible, but
in this variety?
You have to consider your source. To create this on a Philips tape deck, if the Philips cassette came from the source that it supposedly came from, I don't see how the man could do it.
Okay, now you're running a comparison here of the sounds we're listening to, and there's the white noise down at the bottom,
right?
What's the similarities between the two, and what are the really defined differences?
Okay, well, white noise is electronic, unwanted signal in any electronic system, and you see that on the bottom here, footprints, and you can
Mirage fighter that came in. And of course you've seen the photo. Right, there we were. It's fascinating stuff, Lee.
You've heard the second part of that, the Variation 2 sounds, where the dog is barking.
Yes.
And the Mirage fighter.
Yes.
Uh-huh, okay.
So we get all of those other little sounds that the scope is telling everybody about. A Mirage fighter comes over, the dogs bark, and the spaceship is there. I mean, Billy must have a secret studio somewhere that defies conventional wisdom and science in order to produce those sounds on his little Philips tape recorder. We will play a little bit later the sounds of his first recording. That was a Variation 2?
Yes, sir.
That was a Variation 6 craft. The Pleiadians are always changing models on us, quite like they've got a connection with General Motors.
You know, one of the things that's fascinating, too, is we, by the time we got in, you know, one of the problems with this case that I will always regret is the fact that we came in 2 years, almost 3 years too late after it had started, and there were only four photographs left of the Variation 1 type craft, and we managed to salvage, I think we have the four, but we've never released them. One of these days we will.
Yeah,
and then you'll have all six craft, and you'll see a remarkable difference.
Yeah, the latest craft is a weird-looking thing with great big balls all along the outside of it.
Right.
But its capabilities are evidently enormous in that it can travel the distance from here to Pleiades, which is, 500 light-years or thereabouts, in a matter of a few minutes.
I think it's 7 minutes, seven and a half minutes.
And it used to take them an awful long time to make the trip, 7.5 hours.
Right.
So there's obviously no CHP up there with a speed limit. I'm talking to Lee Elders. I'll be right back in Wilton 2, by the way, Lee, at Alexandria 2 Bookstore. She just called in. They have four, I believe it is, so you better hurry. And they also are renting the beam tape. Or the beamship tape, the footage, the Japanese footage there for you that you have an opportunity you can get yourself for your collection. And this is not one of those kind of tapes, I think, that, well, if you rent it once, that'll be great because then you'll want to buy one and keep it in a very, very special place, or it may leave the door because it's quite unusual footage. All right, Milton.
Hi, Bill.
Hi,
Lee.
Hi.
And I've been listening to the sound of the spacecraft on your tape, and I think I have an explanation for you on it.
We'd love to hear it.
About 4 months ago, I was at the Bodhi Tree bookstore, and I found a book called The Janos People, J-A-N-O-S.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book is all about an English family that was taken aboard a spacecraft. Well, fortunately, the husband of this family was an engineer. And the whole family was taken on a Cook's tour of the spacecraft. And especially the husband, John, was taken into the power section of the spacecraft. Now, this UFO was about 350 feet in diameter. And down in the power section, John, the husband, was shown what amounted to a gigantic, huge beam. This is a metal beam that rode on a great, big, huge bearing that was in the middle of the spacecraft.
A metal beam?
A metal beam, yes. They don't say in the book exactly what the metal was.
Oh, when you say beam, you're talking about like a beam overhead, not a beam of light.
Yes, right. I'm talking about a metal beam.
Mm-hmm.
And this beam, according to the book, was over 350 feet in length, well, about 350 feet in length. And they used the beam and made the beam spin with electric power. And when they wanted to raise the spacecraft off the ground, why, they would crank up the beam and away it would go. And of course, the faster the beam turned, the greater the power was and the faster the spacecraft would go. And they say, and the Janos people told him that they used the beam and made it turn and spin only when they were here in the atmosphere of the Earth. When they were beyond it, they didn't need it and didn't use it. But when I can easily visualize this beam spinning at a relatively high speed, I've forgotten how fast it turned, how it would produce the wavering sound that we heard on the tape.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. How old is this book? When was it published?
This book, let me look in the front of it. I have it here in front of me.
It's called The Janos People?
Janos, J-A-N-O-S, The Janos People by Frank Johnson.
Hmm.
And the copyright, it says first published in Great Britain in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, second printing is in 1981.
Uh-huh.
Well, a spinning beam always can evoke all kinds of things, like the breaking of magnetic fields and pulsing of magnetic fields. All of which can make noise.
Uh-huh. And I'm sure that that beam, when it was spinning, would make a... It was a straight beam. It wasn't a three-legged beam or anything
mm-hmm.
like that, a rotor. Actually, they did, in one place in the book, call it a rotor. But mm-hmm. it was a straight metal beam, 300 feet or so in length, that would spin, and that was what counteracted in some way, not explained, how they counteracted and the gravitational force of the Earth.
Now, these ships are about, 21 to 33 feet across, as I recall, Lee, and they are saucer-shaped.
Right.
With some variation on the top part of it there, but basically they're saucer-shaped craft. I think it was Wendell who was telling us that analysis of these sound tapes we also had, part of that sound can be explained by two rotating, say, wheels that are 21 feet across, one rotating in one direction, one the other, counter-rotating planes.
Mm-hmm.
This is about, but I can easily understand, as the beam would spin, Why? Because of its length, and of course because of why you would get different sounds
mm-hmm.
out of the various sections of it as it would spin.
Sure, that's rather perceptive, and I see exactly where you're coming from on that, Milton. That could be so.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So maybe this helps everybody to understand where that sound comes from. Now, I have no idea if the same principle is used in all of the various UFOs, but at least it was in this particular group, and it sounds like the one that you're talking about uses the same principle.
They could be. Even though they come from very scattered points in the universe, physics is still physics.
Yes. The basic principles apparently work no matter who uses them.
That's right. This may be one day we can.
Yeah. I'm hoping that somebody will latch on to this idea and find out and make some experiments with it and see what's going on, and maybe they can make one for us.
Well, I think at the present time, those folks out there are not too interested in us getting too far into space. We'd rather stay in our own backyard until we get our act cleaned up.
Yes, we've got enough trouble down here.
We don't need to be exporting that.
Oh, yeah. By the way, Bill, it's a couple of years ago. I am the one who had the 20-minute visit from Natalie Wood on the day of her funeral.
Oh, yes. I remember you telling me about that.
Yes, yes. I wrote you a letter about
it. Yes, you did.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Any further visits?
I didn't hear you.
Any further visits?
No more visits after that one.
Well, let's hope all things are well.
Yes. Well, you see, the last remark I made to her, she didn't like to hear that at all. And so I don't think she decided she didn't like me.
Oh.
So she left and didn't come back.
All right, Milton, thank you very, very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you much.
We're 19 minutes away from midnight. At midnight, there will be a break for news, of course, and then Tom Hall will jump into this seat and keep going, and he's going to have quite a character with him tonight, an old friend of mine and probably a friend of yours, too. Gary Franklin will be here. Gary Franklin of Channel 2 fame. He and I used to work together over at KFWB. Gary is really into the movies, and he has a way of calling the shots as he sees them. You may not agree with him, but he certainly says the way he sees them, and he is he's quite a fella. So join Gary Franklin along with Tom Hall right after Little Boy.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Lee. Sorry I tuned in kind of late on this show tonight, because it's really a good one.
So am I sorry you did.
I'm a co-worker with Dave Froning, which I heard you mention a couple of times. He kind of got me interested in these things. And I've read the investigation report and Volume 2, the picture book, and I'm still looking for Volume 1, which seems to be impossible to find.
But... Well, if you find it, get ready to depart with some money.
Yeah, I saw it about 2 years ago, and I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. I'll come back and buy it, and never saw one since. But anyway, my question concerned pretty much the propulsion of these things. It seems that they're kind of reluctant to divulge any specific physics of how they work, except generalities of that they do go into higher dimension, which seems to be a timeless, like, void, and they can transverse, you know, kind of go around the back of space, so to say, and get here in very short time. And I wanted to ask Lee if there's been, like, any documentation of what they see in that dimension. You know, they tend to be saying that there's spiritual beings and there's also flesh and blood beings like we are. And I was wondering if when they go into that dimension, if that is the realm of these supposedly spiritual beings. And do you have any comments on that?
Our information is very, very limited in that area. Extremely limited.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Lee?
Oh, sure. Our information in that area is extremely limited. Now, Meyer did ask questions, but he was told that, they couldn't answer certain questions. And in reviewing the contact notes, you see this all the way through. When it comes to propulsion, they give you a few hints, a few keys, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the manufacture of the metal, We do know that there's seven processes that the metal goes through. Vogel came close, I think, when he was analyzing the three or four segments that he got into. But we really don't have all the answers. Now, I don't know if they're giving us subliminal clues, and it's up to us to figure out what it is.
They gave him enough clues about the propulsion system in a very general way, and he wrote about them, as I recall, one of Wendell's conversations here, that when physicists at NASA looked at some of those notes, said that this one-armed farmer who was in the sixth grade was talking about things that they see on the drawing board for 100 years from now.
Yeah.
The jump propulsion system and some of the others, which was simply a matter of breaking down the space-time continuum. We are now able to break down that space-time continuum, by the way.
Have they given any reason for the updating of the ships, like the designs? I was curious, you know, they're talking about going into a higher dimension to travel, and I didn't know if with the updating of the new ships, if they're even using maybe even higher dimensions, because you said they've cut down the time.
Yeah, they hired some designers from General Motors.
Well, one of the problems, now this new ship surfaced for the first time in 1981, and Billy went out to a forest preserve named Dirt Stolen, and there he took like 27 photographs. We tape, Billy, sometime we have a chance, Bill, I'd like to send you some of these transcripts or the tapes themselves. Britt spent a lot of time with Billy on this issue. And out of 27 photographs, that was it. And then they retired the ship. I'm talking about Variation 6 now. They claim that the pollutants in our environment, in our atmosphere, the metal started to break down. And they had to retire it. And they went back to the old standby, the DC-3, as you may, Variation 2. And we only, you know, we only got to see that ship for a very brief period of time.
Is that the one with all of the big balls around it?
Yes, the cylinders, yes.
So it's no longer in service.
Rob Shellman, when he was analyzing this, it was very interesting. We were up in Seattle. He was analyzing. He had never seen photographs of Variation 6. And he all of a sudden he started drawing these circles on this plain piece of white paper. And he drew about seven or eight of them. And he says, to me it sounds like they're generating a magnetic wave. And what he was doing was drawing the cylinders around the ship. And then when we showed him the photograph, that blew him away. And that happened in 1982.
Well, my friend John Bedini has looked at that carefully, and he thinks that those are generating an A-field, which generates a time wave, which is... don't ask me to explain that. I just repeat what they tell me.
Yes.
When you say that the travel time is 7 hours, now it's down like 7 minutes,
seven.
Is that the time of the occupants relative to them on the ship, or is it like an instantaneous happening to them?
As Billy explained it, it was this way. It takes them approximately 3.5 minutes to leave. Now, I'm talking about the, I guess we would call the gravity pull of the Pleiades, and 3.5 minutes to enter into, through our gravity pull of our system. So in essence, it's instantaneous.
Mm-hmm. Most of the journey.
Yeah, they're just...
That's for only Variation 6. The other ships cannot do that.
That fast. Yeah, they have to speed. They have to speed up to a null point,
mm-hmm.
and then they have to slow down from it. But the actual job of getting from here to there, other than the speed up slow down time, is a total folding of space time.
Mm.
And if you want to know what that's like, just get a piece of paper. And if you want to go from one corner of it to the opposite corner, well, if you traveled linearly, it would take you, say, 500 light years. But fold those two corners together, and you could see you could jump from corner to corner in a microsecond.
Yeah.
Well, I would like you to ask your friend Dave about this. I mean, he could answer this question much better than I can.
Yeah, it's also speculative, you know, and
oh, sure.
You kind of work under the covers at being in a big engineering firm, because a lot of the people that are kind of look at you, you start even mentioning it, and they go,
Well, I've talked to a lot of those aerospace engineers, and there's quite a legion of them that have a rough organization. And they're putting a lot of facts that have come into each one of those aerospace firms about UFOs together privately, and are really telling quite a story.
Yes. Well, there is quite a bit of research being done on it, contrary to what a lot of people think. just in the circles that I'm in, I see a lot of it, and it's got to the point where it's more than just mind, you know, like think tank things.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very interesting. I'm very excited about getting any new information that comes out, so I'll be looking forward to it.
Have you seen the footage?
No, I haven't. In fact, I got the thing in the flyer yesterday in the mail from Genesis 3 on it.
Wow, I think you'll really enjoy that. There's a lot of not only information in it, because we cover Billy for the first 17 minutes and how he takes his photographs, and we take you to Hassenbohl and show you the site where he took hundreds of photographs, and then we go into the movie footage. It's quite interesting tape.
Yes. Well, I'm from an area of the United States, like Midwest, Indiana, where there's a lot of prevalent UFO sightings, and I've seen one or two myself. In fact, it's close to Muncie, where they filmed the beginning part of Close Encounters. And I thought that was very fitting, because there are a lot seen there, so they must have done the research a little bit when they made that movie. Okay, General, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Good night.
What is that address again, in case someone missed it, as we've given it here?
Yes.
It's Craig.
Oh, Craig.
Right. Bill, we were in contact with you a couple years ago. My father is Leon. I don't know if you remember.
I believe.
We had some letters back and forth.
Yes.
And actually, I wanted to ask Lee, we had sent a tape in to Wendell a while back, made from a crystal that we had found here in Northridge.
Uh-huh.
Made from the crystal?
Well, a tape, right. We were recording. We had found the crystal, and we had started making a recording. I was recording just something in the house, and when we played back the recording, it had a bunch of frequencies and was making everything echo, and then we just recorded the crystal itself, and when someone would hold it would change pitch.
Crystals do that.
And Wendell, when he heard it, we played it for him over the phone, said that it matched a tape that he had heard from someone in Canada.
Yes,
so we had sent him a copy of the tape, and we sent him a bunch of...
I have a copy of that tape, yes.
You have a copy of the Canadian tape or theirs?
I'm sorry, of the Canadian tape of the saucer.
Right.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear theirs?
No. Did you ever receive our tape is what I want to
know. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't... You sent it to...
To Wendell.
To Wendell? Gosh, I don't know, but I'll certainly find out for you.
Okay. Also, you know, I guess we should contact Wendell again. My father is a very good telepathic receiver and receives things all the time. And, in fact, we, alongside, we're doing quite a bit of our own research into the ancient history aspect of the Pleiades.
Yes.
And I have quite a bit of information that I'm going to send you that's up to date on some of
the
stuff
we're
doing.
Oh, we'd love to have it. We haven't even scratched the surface in that area. I was talking to, I think, a Marine earlier, young lady, and I told her about our priorities, and that's one of them that we're really lacking in, and I wish we had more information.
Right. Well, I've got tons of it. I've spent the past 6.5 years all my spare time doing research into the ancient history aspect of it.
Well, then you're very familiar with the synchronicity of seven.
Definitely. And, you know, there's no culture or race or civilization throughout ancient history in any part of the world that doesn't have some sort of connection in its mythology or legends that's dealing with the Pleiades.
Well, that's one of the things that really got our attention, because, first of all, how could this little, like Bill calls him, this little guy over there, hoax this entire thing? But also, how would he know about the connection there with all the civilizations with this star group? And, you know, normally where there's smoke, there's fire.
Right. You know, one of the amazing things is that both the Egyptian and the Mayan hieroglyphic for Pleiades are identical. And you're talking two civilizations that were not only thousands of miles apart, but thousands of years apart.
Well, the Great Pyramid is a standing tribute to Pleiades.
Right, and some of the Mayan ones are as well, and then there's a definite connection there.
And you've seen Volume 2, I would guess, on the Native American connection to the Pleiades.
Right.
That we just found recently, and that literally was mind-boggling to us.
Oh, yes. I have some stuff I'll be sending you, or I'd like to send you.
Please do. We'd love to have, especially in that area, because, as I say, we've been very lax in researching that area because we've had other things to do.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, Craig?
Okay, terrific. And I guess I'll just call Wendell then and get in touch with you that way.
All right.
Okay, right. Thanks a lot, though.
Very good. And Florence, you're on.
Hello, Bill.
Hi.
Is Wendell Stevens going to be back on? I heard him a few weeks ago.
You heard him a few weeks ago?
Yeah, wasn't he on your show? Or do I have him confused with someone else?
I had Edwin Slade on about 6 weeks ago. I haven't had Wendell on in a couple of years.
Okay, is Edwin Slade the man from Las Vegas?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just had the names mixed up.
Yeah.
Well, talking about the size of the ships, a little while ago, this man called in about a metal beam 350 feet long. Well, aren't some of the motherships that stay in the upper atmosphere much larger than the ships that come down?
They defy imagination in size.
Yeah, like a football field.
Oh, no, much, much larger than that.
If I can quote Billy here now, if I can jump right in on this, you might find it interesting, both of you. The next tape we're doing, which will probably be April or May of next year, is called The Meyer Chronicles. It'll be 2 hours. But there's an interesting segment there where Yowie Junichi asked Billy what it's like on board the ship. And they're walking out to a site, and Billy says it's like a watching central. Now, this is one of the major problems we had with Meyer for about a year and a half, and that was breaking down his code. And there was a code there.